This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. On Friday the 22nd of July 1966, two workmen had been clearing some brush for the Lake Summit Corp in Henderson County, North Carolina. They decided to go and dump the cuttings and the clearing they knew about off of North Lake Summit Road. It was kind of a bit of the beaten track, you'd have to go up this dirt track to reach it. I assume it was a spot they'd used before to dispose of brambles, whatever they were cutting. But this time when they turned up, they found a very strange sight. Three mannequins lying in the clearing. Only of course, as we know all too well, it's never a mannequin. What the workers saw were the bodies of Vernon Shipman, Charles Glass, and Louise Davis Shoemate, all of whom had disappeared 5 days earlier on Sunday the 17th of July. Their bodies were in bad shape, they'd all been bludgeoned to death, all three victims suffering with head wounds, and Louise and Charles also had multiple stab wounds on their chests and neck. Louise's body also showed very clear signs of sexual assault. This was a very violent murder, and to top it off, the bodies seemed to have been sort of posed or arranged after their deaths in a very strange semicircle shape. Oh, and again, on top of that, whilst Vernon and Charles knew each other very, very well, Louise, it seems, was a stranger. There was no connection between them, but here they are now, intrinsically connected forever. These murders, known as the Blue Ridge Murders, happened 58 years ago now, and officially, they're unsolved. But as we will come to discuss, unofficially, it does seem that it has been solved. Or maybe that is a bit dramatic. There's one very, very, very good suspect. This isn't a case that's had a load of coverage, it's probably one that the vast majority of you have never heard of before. And pretty much all of the information we do have about this case comes from the work of a journalist called Jenny Giles, from a series of articles that she wrote back in 2006-2007. As always, all of my sources will be linked down below, but without Jenny and without her investigation, I wouldn't be able to make this. There would literally be no information out there. Her work literally opened up new leads in this case, with the hopes that it could actually be closed. It wasn't, but they got close. But let's talk about this case, starting with a bit about the victims. Vernon Shipman was said to be a very kind and gentle man. He was somebody who was very well liked around Henderson County. People who knew him described him as a gentleman. He was very soft-spoken, polite, dignified. If he could help somebody, he did so. Vernon loved to cook, he loved to entertain at his house with dinner parties, and every single Sunday he'd invite people round to the house he shared with his father, where he would cook up this huge feast for anywhere from 6 to 20 people. He just loved to be surrounded by others, having stimulating conversation. Vernon's past, though, was a bit strange, something people have brought up after his death, as if it had anything to do with his murder. I don't think it did. So he graduated Hendersonville High School in 1944 in the thick of World War II, and he was swiftly drafted into the army along with every other man his age. However, Vernon never ended up going off to fight, as not even a year later, he was discharged, being sent back home. This was seemingly a source of shame, or maybe he was traumatised by what had happened, because Vernon never discussed his time in the army with anyone. So no one really knows what happened though. But I do have an inkling, because Vernon was a gay man. I did have to do a bit of research surrounding all this, surrounding whether or not gay men were allowed to serve in the United States military in World War II, because you would assume they'd won all the manpower they could get, but it seems like that was not the case if the manpower was gay. According to Wikipedia, which I know isn't always the best source, but it was the most clear information I could find, before 1949, each branch of the military tended to charge personnel caught engaging in homosexual conduct with sodomy. They would court-martial them and issue them a dishonourable discharge. In 1940, some psychiatrists came up with guidelines for psychiatric screening for military inductees, of which screening for homosexuality was a very big part. I would love to one day do some more research into this, perhaps for another video, because I'm very intrigued to know what screening for homosexuality consisted of. But my point is, gay men were not accepted into the military, even to fight in World War II. It disqualified inductees from the service. We don't know why exactly Vernon was discharged, his discharge papers have never been available, but I'd say that this is as good a guess as any. It actually seems lucky that he was never actually charged with the crime, if he was found to be gay and trying to serve in the army. Again, it's a guess that that is why he was discharged, but I'd say it's a good enough one. Because whilst people in Hendersonville, where he lived, generally knew that Vernon was gay, it wasn't exactly a secret, it was still something spoken about in hushed tones, something to be gossiped about, something that a lot of people didn't exactly agree with. And of course they didn't. It was Appalachia in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. Like, they didn't like gay. But Vernon was such a gentleman, he was such a kind man, who put on these really great dinner parties and entertained everyone. That he was just generally accepted in society for the most part. At some point in the late 40s or early 50s, Vernon met a man called Charles Glass. Now, we don't know how they met, and in the articles about this case, it's not explicitly said that the pair were a couple, boyfriend and boyfriend, so I don't know if they were together or if they were just two good friends drawn to each other by shared experience of being gay in this area. Maybe they were a couple, maybe they were just close, either way, doesn't really matter. The pair went into business together and opened up a cafe. But the cafe didn't last very long before they moved on to their next venture, a record store called Tempo Music. Vernon was simply an owner of the store alongside working a full-time job at the NC Employment Security Commission, but Charles actually worked at the store all the time. And it was actually a really successful business for them. Charles would work managing the music shop during the day, and at night he worked as a night clerk at the Vanderbilt and Battery Park hotels in Asheville. He also wrote a column for the local Hendersonville newspaper, the WNC Tribune, and he wrote this kind of like satirical advice column called Aunt Klondike, and it was really, really popular. Around town though, Charles was most known for his love of music. He loved blues and rock especially, and he was a musician himself. He opened for a number of fairly big names in the area. He'd lived in Baltimore throughout the 40s and even recorded his own albums. When he met Vernon, they'd start to record music together. One of the songs they recorded was eerily called Screaming and Dying, and it actually got released nationwide, getting a small amount of attention. It got written up in a magazine called Cashbox, which apparently is like being written about in Billboard today, which is a pretty big deal. Just like Vernon, Charles had entered the army in the late 1940s. He was a bit younger than Vernon, being just 36 years old when he died in 1966.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
But also, just like Charles, he would be discharged in August 1951. Again, there's no record showing why he received a general discharge instead of an honourable discharge. Again, we could maybe speculate it's the gay thing, we don't really know. But also, just like Vernon, Charles was a very sociable man. He would often host these large parties at his house. He'd invite 100 people or more. He loved to go out to the clubs. And one night, he somehow managed to break his left leg below the knee. He broke his shin from knee to ankle. That's a pretty bad break and it required a lot of medical treatment, so much so that at the time of his death, he was still on crutches and wearing a boot on his left foot. After this, he never quite walked the same again. So you've got this man who was a relatively successful musician, I suppose. He was really well liked, he threw these amazing parties for everyone. But he was also quite a controversial figure around Asheville and Hendersonville. Charles was a white man, but he was a huge fan of black music and he was really well loved by the local black community. He would come into his store and chat with him, buy records. In the South in the 1950s and 60s, this was a huge deal in a town where integration was only just beginning and people did not like it. On top of being a known gay man, this wouldn't have made him the most popular person amongst the white community. He also apparently used to hang out at all the local black beer joints. He was quite entrenched in the local black community. However, I don't know if you'd call him a friend of the community. Charles was super interested in voodoo apparently. He published booklets on black magic under the name of Charles Le Vert, which is a French word meaning glass. The narrator of the booklet was a black woman called Mama Tebe who would tell the reader how to work the magic, and Charles would make up elixirs and sell them to black people out the back of his shop. But it was literally all just a con. He would take herbs, oregano and thyme, he'd crush them up and put them in these tiny little bags and sell them to the black community as voodoo curses, charms and hexes. He really did take advantage. Charles was also super interested in Asian culture as well, literally naming his home Hong Kong Hill. It was stuffed full of Asian art and plants. He had this Chinese gong on his porch that he'd just go out and like ring frequently. He even had a turban that he would put on to wear as he sat down by the creek and chanted. By 2024 standards, some could argue that this is cultural appropriation or maybe cultural appreciation, but by the standards of the time, it was just very quirky, odd behaviour. Charles was just a weird guy, a homosexual. But was his behaviour enough to get him some enemies, some people who might have wanted him dead? Charles never failed to turn up to work at Tempo until Monday the 18th of July 1966, and Vernon also failed to turn up to his job as well. An employee called Calvert Hunter Jr., who had worked part-time at the shop for years, said that he'd last seen the pair on Sunday afternoon as Vernon was driving on Little River Road towards Flat Rock. He reported seeing Charles in the front seat next to Vernon, but there were also two people sat in the back seat as well, who he didn't know. And he wasn't the only person to report seeing them with two other strangers on that day. When Vernon didn't return home that Sunday, his father Harley, with whom he lived and was very, very close, knew instantly that something bad must have happened. Yes, his son was 43 years old, but he knew his routines. He knew that he wouldn't just not come home and not let him know. Distraught, on the Monday or Tuesday, Harley stormed into the Times News offices, the local newspaper, and demanded that they change the next issue's front page and put a photo of his son on there. Harley was causing such a fuss that everyone in the office had to pay attention, with the circulation manager, a man called Ronnie Hollifield, coming out to say that he'd seen Vernon on the Sunday afternoon. He said he'd seen Vernon driving towards Crab Creek Road with Charles in the passenger seat, and he also reported seeing two people sat in the back, a man and a woman. It wasn't until the Wednesday though, so 4 days after they went missing, that a missing persons report was officially filed with the Hendersonville Police Department and an official search was finally launched. Police Chief Bill Powers said they didn't properly look when the reports first came in because, both being homosexuals, we thought they were probably off partying someplace. Because that's all gay men do, just party and get into trouble. Stereotypes like this and inbuilt prejudice are so, so dangerous when it comes to crime. But after a few days, the police chief Bill Powers did admit that foul play was becoming a real possibility in their case when they just still didn't come home. Vernon's car was found at 5:30 p.m. on the Wednesday, not far from his house. It was found abandoned on a dirt road, but there was no sign of Charles or Vernon, nor the two strangers they were seen with that Sunday afternoon. That is until the Friday when the workers went to dump their cuttings in a clearing they knew near Green River. One of the men, Charles Hill, said that he could smell the bodies as soon as he got out of the truck. It was this really rotten smell. But still, when he saw the bodies lying there, he assumed they were mannequins. This is such a kind of trope in true crime, but I genuinely think it's just the brain's way of protecting us when we see something traumatic. It just takes a second to process what is really going on. But it was bodies, and as we know, there were three of them. Charles, Vernon, and an unknown at the time, woman. This woman would turn out to be 61-year-old Louise Davis Shoemate, identified through her driver's license that was found at the scene in a small change purse. Louise has been described as a very odd woman, a kind of walking contradiction of a person. She worked at Taylor Instrument Co. in local Arden, and she'd lived in Asheville for 4 years. She was this incredibly, incredibly private person, so much so that even her family had no idea where she lived. She didn't give her address to anyone, but she still loved her family and kept in close contact with them. Like, she called her niece on a weekly basis, probably even more. And when her family eventually did get to visit her apartment to clean it out after her death, they found that it was pretty much bare. She had no personal items, nothing that would make you think that anyone even lived there. She just seemed to live a very bare, empty life. But weirdly, one of the things that Louise was most known for was her photography. She always had a camera around her neck. She was constantly taking photos of everything. But there wasn't a single photo to be found in her apartment. She didn't have a phone, obviously, it was the 60s, she wouldn't have had like a mobile, but she didn't even have like a landline phone. So whenever she wanted to contact people, she had to go to her neighbour's house and call from there. She also got her mail sent to a nearby post office instead of to her home, and she would just go and pick it up quite infrequently. She even kept her age a secret. She told people she was born in 1911, but she was actually born in 1904. Not that anyone ever questioned it, because people who knew her said she looked much, much younger than she really was. I don't really get the feeling that any of this is Louise hiding a big secret or running from something. I think she was just genuinely a very solitary person. I think she just liked to live her life in this way. She was just full of contradictions. She would apparently pick up strangers on the street who needed help, but she was also suspicious of everyone. She loved to take long drives, she always wore sunglasses, like people literally never saw her without them. And sometimes she would just refuse to acknowledge people that she'd known for years. She would just pretend that she didn't know them. Her family described her as very easygoing, just easy to get on with for the most part. However, co-workers described her as rude, difficult, and actually quite racist. Although it was the 60s, I think that was kind of the norm. In 1933, she got married to a man called Azel Francis Shoemate, and together they moved to Massachusetts. But just 4 years later, she returned back to Asheville alone. In 1942, she divorced him, then went to travel around a lot. She went to Dallas, Atlanta, somewhere in Florida, before coming back to Asheville. She was all over the place, but she was finally settled at the time of her death. But how did she know Charles and Vernon? How did she end up lying dead with them in a field? To this day, no one's really quite sure. Was Louise the woman sat in the back of Vernon's car that day? If so, who was the man that was with her? And was he the one responsible for their deaths? I don't know, that's what we're here to explore. But let's talk about the scene of the crime. So by the time the bodies were found, they had been dead for 5 or 6 days, lying out in North Carolina's July heat. So they were pretty severely decomposed, so much so that family members struggled to identify the bodies. And the crime scene itself was all round just bizarre. The bodies are found lying on their backs in a very crude semicircle shape, with Louise on the far right, Charles in the middle, and Vernon on the left. The grass surrounding their bodies was stained with blood and just general bodily fluids. It was a really terrible sight. The men were found fully clothed, so Charles was wearing a blue pinstripe shirt with navy blue pants, and he still had his boot for his broken leg on his left leg. Vernon was in a very similar blue pinstripe shirt and blue pants, but Louise was much more exposed. Her blouse had been pulled off her shoulders, her trousers were pulled down below her knees, and her bra was found a few feet away. All three were found wearing their watches, so robbery seemingly was not the motive here, and Charles was wearing a self-winding calendar watch, which apparently stops working if there's no movement. I'm not really sure what that is. I tried to Google it and I couldn't really find any answers. But this watch had stopped at 1:58 and it doesn't specify whether that's AM or PM. And there's no information on how long it would take for the watch to stop working once movement stopped. So this is kind of a bit of a useless lead. But we do know that Charles and Vernon were both seen alive on that Sunday afternoon at like 6:30 PM, but we'll talk about timeline in a little bit. On top of Louise's body, placed across her neck, they found an empty whiskey bottle just kind of balanced on top of her scarf. Charles' crutches were placed on top of his body in an X shape, and a piece of scrap metal, like an inch wide and 18 inches long, was placed across Vernon's neck. It was all just very odd, very weirdly posed. Like whoever did this wanted to mess with investigators just a little bit, like see how far they could push it. The autopsy found that all three victims died of fractured skulls from heavy blows to the head. Vernon to the right side and Charles and Louise to the left. Charles and Louise had also been stabbed multiple times, puncture wounds found on their bodies. The wounds were kind of described as less than 0.4 centimetres in diameter and only just penetrating under the skin. They were very, very shallow stab wounds. However, Louise did have two wounds that did go deeper. In total, she had 13 puncture wounds and Charles had 21, whilst Vernon, strangely, had none. Louise's death definitely seemed to be the most violent. She had multiple blows to her head, her left wrist and elbow were broken, likely defensive wounds while she was protecting herself. She had bruising encircling her left wrist and bruising just generally over a lot of her body, on her right forearm, on her inner thighs, her left inner knee and her right calf. And she was also just generally covered in grazes and scrapes. There had clearly been some quite serious struggle going on. Of course, this crime happened in 1966 before rape kits existed, but according to experts at the time, Louise wasn't raped, at least not in the literal sense. She was, however, found with the upright portion of an automobile bumper jack inserted into her vagina. Under our modern definition of rape, this definitely counts as such. Now, I did have to Google it because I wasn't really sure what a bumper jack is, but I think it's just a language difference because over here in the UK, we just call it a car jack, one of the tools used to lift up a car to replace a wheel. It's also thought that this was the same object used to beat them all to death. To get all this information, Louise's body was actually exhumed in the spring of 1967. She was sent to the state medical examiner's office. Now, I'm not entirely sure why this wasn't done in the first place and why only she was exhumed, but it means that her body got a much closer looking at than Charles and Vernon's, who were never exhumed. The most baffling part about their injuries has always been the puncture wounds. They weren't exactly stab wounds, like they weren't that deep, and they couldn't find anything that caused these kinds of marks. At first they speculated it could have been an ice pick, but they were too uniform, and also an ice pick would probably go deeper than just like surface level. They also thought about shoes with cleats on the bottom, but there was no pattern to the marks that were on the bodies. They weren't like shoe-shaped marks. So they just couldn't pinpoint it, and no responsible weapon was ever found at the scene. So we still don't know what caused these puncture wounds. Although, of course, this was a small town in the 1960s, and the investigation here just generally wasn't the best. The crime scene was destroyed pretty much as soon as people realised what had gone on. Everyone came down to the clearing in hordes to just nose about. The authorities didn't bother to preserve the crime scene. They literally left small pieces of the skull, fluids on the ground. There was no such thing as DNA testing this time. They did take crime scene photos and they did remove some evidence from the scene, but that was about it. This crime became the most sensational thing to happen in Henderson County's history. The Times News headline breaking the news of this triple murder sold 10,000 copies, which was huge for such a small place. Nothing like this had ever happened here before, and it sent shockwaves across the state. And the authorities were quite out of their depth when it came to this investigation. But they started in quite a sensible place. They started by building out a timeline of that weekend. Now, we know that Louise was working that Friday as normal. We know that she called her niece between 6:30 PM and 8 PM on Saturday night. But in terms of Louise's movements that weekend, that's kind of all we know. For Charles and Vernon, we know a little bit more. So on the Saturday, Vernon went to buy a new tyre for his car, and he told the dealer that he was planning a trip. We know he was also at the music shop at Tempo for a bit that day as well, because Calvert Hunt Jr., their part-time employee, stopped by for a bit with his fiancée to show the pair their engagement ring. Calvert said that Vernon seemed to be in a very, very good mood that day, but Charles was much more sullen. Apparently there was a business dinner the next day on the Sunday that Vernon had been invited to, but Charles hadn't been, and he was not happy about it because they were business partners, they should both be going, but Charles, he'd been snubbed. But like, I think a lot of people would probably be a little bit put out by this, I guess. And there's no evidence that the pair knew anything was going to go wrong on the Sunday. Around mid-morning on the Sunday, Charles called a friend and invited him for lunch at a local restaurant. However, this friend had other plans and so had to decline. So Charles ended up staying home until around 2 p.m. when he spoke with Vernon on the phone. Vernon's dad said that Vernon spent the morning just hanging around the house, he had a late breakfast, before he went out at around 2 p.m. The pair were apparently going to meet each other. Between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m, Charles and Vernon went to Johnny's restaurant, which was just a local establishment, where they both had a meal and some drinks. And then afterwards, they popped in to see some friends at an antique shop that they ran, and the friends remembered them talking about what they'd eaten for their meal. And the pair, they seemed happy enough, and then they headed home, back to Vernon's house, it seems. Whilst they had had a late lunch, it seems like Vernon still had that business dinner planned. He was originally meant to be eating at Echo Inn at around 5:30, but at 4:45 p.m, Robert Amston, who I assume he was having the dinner with, is not too clear, but I think he was, called Vernon's house to let him know that the dinner was now going to happen at the country club instead, and that now it was booked for 6 p.m. instead of the originally planned 5:30. But Charles was the one to answer the phone, saying that he'd passed the message on to Vernon. But that wasn't the only call to come in. Apparently at 5:30 p.m, a friend called Sue Nichols also called to speak to Vernon, and once again, Charles answered the phone. Apparently Charles was obviously drunk by this point, and Sue says that she thought she could hear Vernon in the back telling Charles to get off the phone multiple times. And then she heard footsteps, and Charles said, "No, Vernon, God no, don't hit me," and the line went dead. Which, considering what would come to happen, is very suspicious, but we know neither of them were responsible for their own deaths. Like, this wasn't a suicide, this wasn't a murder-suicide, they were murdered by someone else. Meanwhile, all we know of Louise was that she was seen leaving her apartment at around 4:30 p.m. About an hour later, it seems, Vernon and Charles would also leave the house in Vernon's car. A witness would later come forward saying that she saw Vernon's car heading north about 5:45 p.m. She saw Vernon driving and Charles in the front seat, and there were two strangers in the back seat. As we know, multiple other people also came forward saying that they saw the same. This was a small place, small town vibes, everyone knew everyone, everyone was kind of nosy, so people did pay attention to things like this. It was around 6 p.m. that Ronnie Hollifield, the circulation manager at the newspaper, also saw them, which is when Vernon was meant to be at dinner. Ronnie says he came across them on this narrow dirt road, the kind of narrow where two cars can't really pass by each other, so Ronnie stopped his car to let Vernon pass, waving as he did so, but Vernon did not wave back. He says that he saw the man and woman in the back, he saw Charles' crutches on the seat between them in the front, and he also got quite a good view of the back passengers, with the woman smiling at him as they passed. He said the man was white, he was wearing sunglasses with light-coloured, thin hair. He said he didn't get a solid look at his face, but he said it was a thin man with a dark blue pinstripe suit, and he noted that the suit was somewhat outdated. He said the man was about 40 to 50 years old. Now, Vernon was meant to be picking up Robert Amston at the Echo Inn before 6 p.m. to head to their dinner reservation at the country club, but he just never turned up. Robert ended up cancelling the dinner reservation but waited around till 7 p.m. just in case, but Charles and Vernon were just driving around nowhere near the Echo Inn. Their employee, Calvert Hunt Jr., said he remembered seeing them at 6:30 p.m, saying he knew the car well as he drove often. He remarked at the time how weird it was because he knew that Vernon had this dinner engagement and he also knew that Charles hadn't been invited. So why was he in the passenger seat of this car? And that was the last known sighting. The car, as we know, wouldn't be found until the Wednesday, found on a dirt road parallel to the railway tracks, just a few streets away from Vernon's home. Locals said the car had been there since at least 7 a.m. on the Monday, but it was nowhere near the bodies. Seemingly, it had been moved to this point. The keys were in the car when it was found, but the keys wouldn't open the car boot. Apparently, the mechanism had broken quite a long time ago, so Vernon had kind of rigged up this system where he would stick his hand through the back seat to open it. There was kind of like a hole large enough for an arm in the middle of the back seat. Taking a look through this opening in the back seat into the boot, investigators could see the base and handle of a bumper jack, but the shaft of it was missing, later to be found at the crime scene. They also found a brand new jack as well from a 1961 Pontiac, and another jack was also found on the rear floorboard, which is a lot of jacks for just one car. His car was a 1962 blue Ford Fairlane. I don't think I mentioned that before, but it is relevant. The amount of jacks found at the scene wasn't the weirdest thing about the car. Three of the tyres were said to be very muddy, and one was clean, and two hubcaps were also missing, although apparently one had already been previously stolen, so there was just like one new hubcap missing. There was no spare tyre found in the trunk, so they maybe wondered, could the clean tyre just been the spare one that had just been put on? And there were also scratches found all down the side of the car. It was just this really baffling scene. On the rearview mirror, investigators found two latent fingerprints, and in the car's right rear ashtray, they found cigarette butts from the Pall Mall brand, which was known to be the brand that Louise smoked, and one of them even had lipstick stains. Investigators also found that Vernon had had the car's oil changed on Friday, just 2 days before his death. But it was found that in those 2 days, the car had been driven 259 miles, even though Vernon hadn't really been anywhere. The trip from his house to where the bodies were discovered was about 38 miles, and obviously he'd been driving around a little bit over the weekend, but not 200 plus miles worth. However, that particular piece of the puzzle would be solved 9 months after the murder, when a teenager came forward admitting that him and some friends had found Vernon's car just before sunset on Sunday the 17th of July. Him and his friends decided to steal it and take it for a joyride before parking it in the spot where it would later be found. It's not entirely clear to me whether they originally found the car near the crime scene where the bodies would be found and then they parked the car near Vernon's house on this dirt road, or if they found it originally on this dirt road then just returned it to where they found it, if that makes sense. I think it was the latter, but it wasn't entirely clear. They said they originally intended to strip the car of all its tyres and actually returned back later that night with a jack, but they got scared last minute and decided not to do it, so the jack left on the back floorboard of the car was theirs. However, they did say that the spare tyre was definitely missing when they found the car, and I don't see why they'd lie about that, so there's still some very odd things about this scene. So whilst we know that Vernon was driving around in his car on that Sunday evening, Louise had also left her apartment building in her own car about 4:30 p.m. and her car was also a 1962 light blue Ford Fairlane, almost exactly the same as Vernon's. On Tuesday 19th, such a car was reported as abandoned near the French Broad River in a very quiet area. The car was found with the windows down, the doors unlocked, and the keys still in the ignition. In the back of her car, they found a complete bumper jack, and her purse was also hanging on the door handle. Louise's involvement in this case has always been a very baffling part of the investigation, because was she the woman sat in the back of Vernon's car? People think that she must have been, but there's no solid proof that she actually 100% was. Or could it have just been a case of wrong place at the wrong time for her? Where her car was found was relatively close to the crime scene. In the early days of the investigation, there was a lot of speculation that maybe she'd gone blackberry picking, which is very popular in this area, and she'd done it in this area with a friend before. Maybe she just so happened to be there when the murderer and Charles and Vernon appeared. But there was no proof of this. There was nothing found at the crime scene or in the car that would support this blackberry picking theory. The big question has always been, did Louise know Charles and Vernon? We know they were super popular people, they were very social, they knew a lot of locals. But Louise wasn't. She was solitary, she was a loner. Most authorities at the time did think this really was just a case of wrong place, wrong time, but there is some loose evidence that maybe they did know each other. For example, Louise told a friend that she had a very good friend who had a car just like hers, and Louise and Vernon did indeed have the same car. And her niece would say that Louise would often travel to Hendersonville from her home in Asheville to spend a weekend or sometimes even a week with friends. Could those friends have been Charles and Vernon? Times News reported that when Charles was in hospital in the winter of 1965 to 1966, I assume with his leg issues, a woman came to visit him, and an employee at the hospital identified Louise as the woman in question. There's some people who recognise her as somebody who maybe came to some of Charles's parties, but still none of this is solid, it's all speculation relying on people's memory, which can very much mould itself to fit the situation at hand, so it doesn't really mean that much. Louise's family also always speculated that she may have had a prescription drug problem. It was something that was always kind of spoken about behind closed doors, but never in public. But the family said Louise had no way of getting said drugs, so she may have been getting them illegally. And it was known that Charles's parties would often be drug-fueled. A retired deputy sheriff would later say, Shipman and Glass catered the nightclubs in Asheville. Word was they gave drugs for sexual favours. But this is not a rumour that I would take at face value, because we don't know how much of this was born from stereotypes about gay people. The sheriff already said they didn't bother looking for them at first because they were gay, they must have just been out partying somewhere. I'm not saying the drug party rumours are categorically not true, but I am saying take it with a pinch of salt, especially because they're saying they traded drugs for sexual favours, sort of perpetrating the stereotype of gay men as drug and sex crazed. But if this was true, if Louise was attending parties with drugs on a regular basis, it could all come under the umbrella that she had drug issues and her family very much thought as much. Apparently every Thursday, Louise would bring a package to work wrapped in brown paper and tied with string, and then she'd hand it to the security guard. There was lots of speculation about this amongst co-workers who also all came to the decision that she was a drug addict or maybe a drug dealer. There's lots of questions as to how she was affording this lifestyle because her job wasn't particularly well paid, but if she was also dealing drugs as well as taking drugs, that could be something. A couple of years after her death, her brother got a call from the Asheville Federal Savings and Loans Department saying that Louise had a savings account with $12,000 in it, which is about $116,000 today. Louise didn't live a lavish lifestyle, she didn't earn that much money in her job, so where on earth had this money come from? No one knows. Maybe she was just very frugal, but her family certainly were taken by surprise, because that was a lot of money in those days. It still is a lot of money. What kind of lifestyle was Louise hiding from them? So as you can imagine, a big part of this case in the early days and still now was hinged on who was the fourth person in the car. If we are, of course, working under the assumption that Louise was the woman in the back. Two composite sketches have been drawn of the man from the witnesses, but for the life of me, I haven't been able to find these composite sketches anywhere online in the research process, so I don't know, I don't have it to share with you. Then Sheriff Paul Hill did have a theory that he shared with the Times News in the early days, that Louise left her apartment at 4:30 p.m. and then drove to the spot on the French Broad River where her car would later be found. It was here that an unknown person, an unknown male, likely joined her. Together they left in another car and drove to Hendersonville where they joined Charles and Vernon at Vernon's house. Then shortly after 5:30 p.m. the group left in Vernon's car and drove around, eventually coming to stop at the point where their bodies would later be found, where they would be killed. Vernon's car was left abandoned there, and then we know the car's story from that point. It likely either got moved or stolen. Of course, though, this was just a theory, but it does kind of make sense. The big question is, though, why would Louise leave her keys in the ignition if she left willingly, and why was her purse just hung on the door handle? They are two questions that we do not have answers to. With a complete lack of actual leads, all investigators could do here was just rule things out. For example, they heard rumours of the Klan's involvement, the KKK, so they looked into that. Obviously, with both men, Charles and Vernon, being out for the 60s in a small Appalachian town, and with Charles being so closely intertwined with the black community, it was something worth looking into. In the 1960s, apparently, when his friend, blues singer Little Esther Phillips, came to stay in his home, a cross was burned in his yard, Esther, of course, being a black woman. So he was very much on the KKK's kind of radar. They knew of his existence and that he was close with the black community. And they also would have known he was gay because kind of everyone did. It was a whispered, like, gossip. And with Charles being found with his crutches laid in a cross across his body, just the general weird ceremoniousness of the whole scene, they wondered if the Klan could be responsible. But experts have looked into this possibility as recently as 2006, and they've not found anything that might indicate Klan or other white supremacist involvement. They have said it doesn't mean it's impossible, but there's no evidence to point in that direction. There was also talk of the occult being involved, again because of the seeming ceremoniousness of the whole scene and Charles's involvement with voodoo, but again there just isn't any evidence beyond the visuals. So they could rule out these things, but they couldn't find any actual helpful leads. I mean, one huge problem that the investigation encountered was that obviously Charles and Vernon were gay, and so were a lot of their friends and acquaintances, but they were likely closeted. Charles and Vernon would throw these big wild parties where who knows what went on behind closed doors, who knows what kind of alliances people had, who was friends with who. And the police couldn't find out because historically, the queer community has always had a massive distrust of the police. And for good reason, homosexuality was illegal in the vast majority of states at this time. I mean, it wasn't until 2003 that the United States Supreme Court ruled that laws criminalising consensual homosexual activity between adults unconstitutional. Until 2003. For a long time, even still now perhaps, a gay person couldn't report a hate crime against them because it would result in them getting arrested. Police would entrap gay men, coming onto them and then arresting them for the crime of being gay. So police and the queer community have always had a very tumultuous relationship. So when Vernon and Charles suddenly ended up murdered, a huge part of their community, their inner circle, didn't want to come forward and speak to the police because chances are they would end up getting in trouble themselves. Maybe people had important information they just never felt comfortable being able to share. Perhaps in sharing the information they had, they would be outing themselves or others, which was a life-ruining thing in the 1960s. When rerunning the story in 2006, I think they hoped that people might finally come forward, but of course 40 years had passed and those who grew up in this era still probably didn't want to publicly out themselves. So still in 2006, still now, there are people who might have information but just don't feel comfortable coming out and admitting that they were friends with gay men and all the implications that come along with that. Years passed and this case remained cold. It became somewhat of an embarrassment for the local sheriff's office and the police department, who kind of both worked on this together. Eventually, an FBI investigator did take a look through the files and they did put forward a very brief profile of the perpetrator, saying they were likely a local individual who knew the area well, the victims knew their attacker, and it was somebody who disliked women. Which is something I think anyone who's watched more than one true crime documentary would be able to ascertain. It really wasn't anything groundbreaking. Knew the area well, the victims knew their attacker, and it was somebody who disliked women. Which is something I think anyone who's watched more than one true crime documentary would be able to ascertain. It really wasn't anything groundbreaking. And then, of course, years later, when they started to think that maybe new technology might be able to provide some further answers here, it was discovered that the crime scene evidence had disappeared. The lead investigator at the scene said he'd taken all of the evidence to Rally, including all the film he'd taken. It was kept there until July 1969, when the most important evidence was given to the latest Henderson County Sheriff, James Kilpatrick. There were three boxes of things, including the bumper jacks, the shaft found at the scene, which was thought to be the murder weapon, just generally all of the evidence found at the scene, Charles' crutches, like everything there was in these boxes. All very important things for any reinvestigation, and they've since vanished. The lead investigator said he personally handed over the boxes to Sheriff Kilpatrick, who would apparently not keep some things at the sheriff's office because he didn't think the office was safe. He told people he put the boxes in a safe place, but he's since died and no one knows where it is. There's no record of any of it. Or some other sources say that at the time the old evidence room at the courthouse was undergoing a renovation and there is a chance that a couple of deputies just threw the boxes out, not realising what they were. But regardless, they're gone. Any chance of doing DNA tests and solving this case once and for all disappeared alongside those boxes. But in 2006, they started to make some effort to solve it anyway. They filled out forms for each of the three victims for VICAP, the Violent Criminal Apprehension Programme, which was then sent to the FBI for analysis of violent crime. And then there was talk of forming a task force to reanalyse the case 40 years on, but it's unclear to me if that ever actually happened, because without the evidence, what is there to reanalyse? But it was that same year that journalist Jenny Jones-Giles decided to look into the case herself, writing a whole series of articles, which are again my main primary source for this episode and will be linked down below. She wrote at length about a suspect who many believe today to be the one responsible. And throughout the years, there have been many potential suspects in this case, but none of them ever really panned out, except for maybe this guy. This was a man called Edward J. Thompson Jr., a serial criminal who can be placed in Hendersonville at the time of the murder. Thompson was the last person to be declared an outlaw in North Carolina. He had kidnapped, raped, and murdered victims in North Carolina and Virginia before he was arrested in 1968, with that particular crime spree beginning in the May in 1968 in Henderson County. Over just a couple of months, he kidnapped 9 people, raped 5, and killed 2. For his crimes, he received 5 consecutive life sentences plus 20 years, and he died in Raleigh State Prison in 1989. This was not a good guy. He was committing crimes from when he was a literal teenager. Apparently, he killed his own father with a blow to the head as a juvenile. He's been described as mean, moody, a loner with a bad, bad temper. But is there enough evidence here to actually link him to the Blue Ridge murders, to the triple murder? Well, let me talk you through some of the main points that have been put forward. In Virginia, Thompson murdered a man and left him fully clothed, but the clothes of a woman he murdered were found in disarray, just like Louise. In the case of the same woman, a rubber hose was found draped over her shoulders, similar to the Blue Ridge crime scene, with the scrap metal, the whiskey bottle, and the crutches placed on top of the bodies. Was this maybe some weird MO? When Thompson kidnapped a couple in Henderson County in 1968, he told them, "I have a gun. I've already killed 3 people. 2 more won't make a difference." After each kidnapping of his, and he committed many, he would always bring the car back to near where the crime started and always left the keys in the ignition. He liked to tell people where to drive and made his victims drive him around. So could that have been the case with Vernon? He was supposed to be at dinner and no one's ever come up with any reason as to why he didn't turn up to it. But he was seen just driving around in this time. Thompson would also make the victims drive with both hands on the steering wheel, and witnesses who saw him driving that evening said it did seem very odd that he didn't wave or smile at them as they passed. He just seemed very focused on driving. Thompson always placed victims on their backs and always violated the bodies of the women more than the men. He also weirdly always seemed to commit his crimes on Sundays. In 1947, he was accused of killing a man with an iron pipe and blows to the head, a crime in which he was found not guilty but bore chilling resemblance to Blue Ridge. He also once asked a former Henderson County detective what was going on with the triple murder investigation, and after his 1968 arrest, Hendersonville police officers found newspaper clippings of the triple murder in his home. He definitely seemed to have enough of an interest in it to go out of his way and cut it out of the papers. I think it probably can be agreed that this is all pretty damning evidence, but it's all circumstantial, there's nothing forensic. And it's also worth pointing out that Edward Thompson was a black man, and witnesses all identified the fourth passenger in the car that day as being white. However, Thompson was said to be particularly light-skinned and he was wearing sunglasses, so maybe in passing at a quick glance, it could have been assumed that he was white. But then Ronnie Hollifield also said the man had light hair, so who knows? The circumstantial evidence against this guy was so strong that apparently at one point the FBI told deputies to go ahead and charge him, that there was enough evidence. But the district attorney didn't think so, and Thompson had a very good lawyer, like good enough that he would probably get off, so he was never charged with the crime. Back in 1968, when he was first arrested for his crime spree, Thomas wasn't questioned about the Blue Ridge murders, nor were his fingerprints tested against those found on the rearview mirror of the car. In 1969, though, two investigators did go to visit him in prison to ask about the murders, but he said he didn't know what they were talking about, that he had nothing to do with it. In the years since, they have requested his fingerprints for comparison, but it doesn't look like much really came of that. With a complete lack of forensic evidence here, it cannot be said that Edward Thompson was 100% the perpetrator of this crime. As I said, he has since died. I think he died in 1989, so it's not looking likely that we're going to get a confession at this point. And without the DNA from the crime scene, they can't do testing to confirm or deny their suspicions. All I will say is there is a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case, but I don't think it's quite enough to unequivocally say that Thompson was the perpetrator. A very, very good suspect, sure, he was a bad man through and through. To say it was definitely him, there's not quite enough. It's been almost 60 years since these murders, and locals in Henderson County still do want to see it solved. I just don't see how they're going to get those answers without the DNA evidence to test. But hey, maybe they'll find the box hidden away somewhere one day. There's always hope. But then that does raise some questions about chain of custody and like the legitimacy of the DNA. Like, could they even do that? I suppose if the perpetrator does turn out to be Thompson, then it doesn't really matter now because he can't be charged because he's dead, but it would be answers. But could they even class as an answer if they haven't really like known where this DNA evidence has been for the last 50 years? I don't really know. When I went into researching this case, I thought it was going to be just a relatively short, straightforward case to cover. I did not expect it to become such a tangled web of secrets, hidden friendships, so many layers. A big part of this mystery is how Charles and Vernon knew Louise, if they knew her at all. I do find myself wondering if maybe she was gay herself, like that could explain why she kept her family, kept everyone at arm's length. But she did seem to have these gay men as very close friends. Maybe she liked to keep her life impersonal because of the shame she felt around that. Maybe not, of course, maybe she was a drug addict, as her family think, but I can't help but wonder. I do wonder if some people in the men's close circle might have had some answers here, but if Thompson was the perpetrator, it was very likely to be a random attack. His attacks were usually random, just in the moment, so maybe people didn't have any answers. But also, if it was Thompson, if it was this single man, this thin-built man, was he going to be able to overpower three people, like two men and a woman? Like, how does that work? How does he attack one of them without the others running or attacking him back? I saw speculation that there must have been more than one perpetrator here, and honestly, I see that. But there was only one extra person in this car, unless, this is me riffing now because my script has ended, unless the two people in the back were both perpetrators, Vernon and Charles were the victims, and Louise just so happened to be at the scene minding her own business and got herself involved in this. Maybe. Who knows? I truly hope we'll see some answers in this case someday. Maybe there will be people out there who knew Vernon and Charles who might know more, who've always been scared to come forward. But honestly, I don't see them being brave enough to come forward at this point. Maybe there'll be some kind of deathbed confession at some point, maybe, but this attack happened nearly 60 years ago now, so it's looking unlikely. But there's always hope. There's always hope in cases like this. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I will see you guys in the next one. See ya.